And tonight, we are going to be talking with two very interesting people. One of them, an old friend who's been with us often, Mark Stein, who I take to be one of the major journalists of the Western world, and the other, Ezra Levant, who's been with us once before. And both of them have a good deal in common. They're both Canadian by origin, though Mark now lives in New England, and Ezra is up in Calgary, Alberta, at this very moment. And gentlemen, good evening. I want to be sure that you're both there. Say hello.
Hi, from Calgary.
Hi, Milt. Hi. Greetings from your old stomping ground of New Hampshire.
Absolutely. You're just a little bit north up or south up or whatever, my old stomping ground in Hanover, New Hampshire.
That's right. You were at college here.
I was indeed,
a little
yes.
ways north of your old college home.
I see tonight's program as a tale of two cities. The two cities are not London and Paris. They are Calgary, Alberta, Vancouver, of course, Vancouver, British Columbia. And a tale of two administrative hearings, or one might say of two star chambers. All of that will become clear in just a moment as I offer you two quotations as the epigraphs for the evening. The first from the redoubtable Samuel Johnson. No, rather, I'll give you the redoubtable John Milton, who says, "Give me the liberty to know, to utter, and to argue freely, according to conscience, above all other liberties." And a more recent person who's also faced some difficulty for things that he wrote and printed, namely Salman Rushdie, who says, "Free speech is the whole thing, the whole ball game. Free speech is life itself." And both of you went up against the Canadian government in separate hearings in which you were challenged and, in essence, threatened with punishment for indulging in journalistic free speech. I've made all of that as a general, broad introduction. It may be a bit mysterious to those who don't know the cases. Therefore, Ezra Levant, drawing from your new book, which reports all of this, that book titled Shakedown, give us the sense of and give us the story of what you went through. And for that matter, you can briefly introduce what Mark went through.
Sure. Thanks, Milt. About 3 years ago, when the Danish cartoons of the Muslim prophet Muhammad were creating news overseas, so much news that, in fact, there were riots in Iran and Syria and Nigeria that killed over 100 people, I was the publisher of a small Canadian news magazine called the Western Standard. And we thought we'd show our readers what all the fuss was about, because no one else in Canada did. No other TV station, no other newspaper or magazine. So we showed the cartoons in the middle of our magazine, not that we necessarily agreed with the cartoons, but just how a prosecutor might put a piece of evidence to the jury. Here's Exhibit A. Here's
As a matter of fact, those cartoons, though 100 or so people were killed in response to those cartoons, they were rather mild stuff, weren't they?
They certainly were, and that's part of the story itself, to show that the riots were just using the cartoons as a trumped-up excuse. Anyways, this caused a lot of debate in Canada, and I like that because that's healthy. But one fella, a Pakistani-born, Saudi-trained, radical Muslim imam, didn't like this at all.
Of course, we should make clear right away that the cartoons, even though they did it rather mildly, were critical of what we would generally call Islamic extremism.
Some of them were. Some of them were very neutral. They didn't really have a point at all. And the imam who complained about what we did, his view was that you ought not to be able to depict Muhammad at all, even in a favorable light, because that would be a form of idolatry, to have a graven image of their prophet. So even if the cartoons were positive, that wouldn't have been good enough for many. Anyhow, this one imam in Calgary took me to the police, and he asked them to arrest me. Now, the police rejected that, and they reminded him that he was in Canada now, not Saudi Arabia
But
anymore.
They've got a special institution in Canada to handle people like you.
That's right, and he found it. It's called the Human Rights Commission, and there's 14 of them in Canada, one for every province and one for the federal government and one for each territory. And they're a government agency, and 40 or 50 years ago, they used to do things like make sure people didn't get fired because they were black or keep Jews out of the country club, things like that. But today, I mean, Canada is such a harmonious place that these human rights commissions have gone and started fighting counterfeit human rights, like the right not to be offended.
Now, I've called this a kind of a star chamber. That is to say, it operates beyond the limits and the the special provisions of a judicial setting, and they make up their own rules as they go, but they have the right to punish you one way or the other. And also, essentially, at almost the same time, Mark Stein came up against a similar commission in Vancouver. What were they after you for, Mark?
Well, Maclean's magazine, which is Canada's national news magazine, it's a bit like Time and Newsweek combined up there.
But better, I would say.
I think it's better. I'm happy to write for them. And they also published an excerpt from my book, America Alone. You had me on the show talking about that book when that came out.
And in fact, I have called it the most important book of the year, the year that it was published.
Yeah, I think you actually said it was the most important book of the decade.
Probably
point.
I did. There you
I, don't, I don't want to undersell you on that. But it appeared in, there was an excerpt published in Maclean's. It was the cover story. It generated a lot of mail in the weeks that followed. The book was a number one bestseller in Canada. And about 6 months afterwards, a similar organization to the fellas who chastised Ezra, the Canadian Islamic Congress, came after Maclean's magazine.
I should ask you for the moment to do a brief sidebar and explain to those who may not know about the book, though they should know about it, what its basic argument was. What then offended this Islamic organization?
Well, the book is called America Alone, The End of the World as We Know It, and it posits the fact that there were huge changes going on principally in Europe, where Europe's demographic crisis, where essentially the Germans, the Spanish, the Italians, and others have given up breeding and have effectively imported a vast Muslim population to be the children they couldn't be bothered having themselves. Now, some of those Muslims just want to do their job and make a nice living and send their kids to school and have a nice house and live in the suburbs. But when you poll them, significant numbers, sometimes between 40 and 60, 70%, wish to live under Islamic law in the United Kingdom, in the Netherlands, and in other European countries. So clearly there's a question mark over the future in some of the oldest nation states in the world. It's very interesting. The UN doesn't dispute it's happening. They call it the fastest population transformation in history. And I think it's something that you should be able to write about. In free societies, you can write about it.
Particularly when in some of the societies, free societies into which that Islamic immigration has come, they are clamoring, many of them are, for the activation of Sharia law, Muslim Orthodox law, as a legal tradition equal to the law of Britain or the law of Canada, or for that matter, the law of the United States.
Yes.
And that would permit some gross deviations from our way of life.
Yes, and you begin to understand in some ways when you look at the system that came down on Ezra and me, why it would appeal to some of these extreme Muslim lobby groups. Because in a sense, it's not a... The human rights system in Canada doesn't have the protections of common law, which is the foundation of the Canadian and the U.S. legal system. They are, in effect, politically correct enforcers. And so if you belong to certain pre-approved victim groups, of which Muslims are one, gays are another, transsexuals or another. There are certain people who are in fashion, and then there are certain people who are out, like fundamentalist Christians, for example,
or Holocaust survivors.
That's right. Jewish groups, what Ezra calls the official Jews, were in some ways many of the early beneficiaries of this system. And then obviously the Muslim lobby groups say, well, if the gays and the Jews can get a piece of the human rights thought police action, why shouldn't we?
But what they were after, essentially, whether in the case of Stein or in the case of Levant, was to get each of you to shut up.
Yes, I think they wanted, in effect, to criminalize my work and Ezra's work and render us unpublishable in Canada.
Now,
came close to that.
Here comes an interesting national difference. I think both the national culture of Canada and the national culture of the United States are in trouble. And I mean the ways in which we live and the ways in which our traditions have been altered in recent time, altered in the main, I would say, for the worse. I speak as the traditionalist conservative that I have in my dotage become. But one thing we've got that you guys don't have is something called the First Amendment. it does really guarantee free speech, and it's the rare occasion, and it's the rare journalist who will be punished for offering an opinion in print, or for that matter, over the electronic media. Whereas you two were being challenged for having offered judgments, opinions, and reportage that took a certain position, critical of the Islamic invasion, so to speak.
Milt, you're right. We do not have the same strong protection that the First Amendment gives Americans. But we do have a very strong history of free speech going back to the 1830s when Joseph Howe beat a seditious libel case for reporting embarrassing facts in the government. We actually have a strong history of liberty. And we fought side by side with the Yanks, you know, and on D-Day to secure these liberties. I mean, we actually were pretty close to you all the way. It's only in recent years that these commissions have been hijacked and turned towards political purposes. And most people who get dragged before the Milk don't have the money or the resources to avail themselves of a constitutional challenge. We don't have the same vigorous ACLU-type groups who would jump in up here. And so these human rights commissions have been busy picking off weaklings for 20, 30 years, building up a jurisprudence that was ready to ensnare me and Mark Stein. And we were, I think, the first two guys who were noisy enough, and in both of our cases, had strong enough lawyers to beat the rap. But it was because no one could avail themselves of these constitutional protections because they picked on weaklings and no one stood up for them.
There is a consequence of this sort of prosecution or persecution, and it is beyond the precincts of the administrative hearing. It is the chilling effect that this kind of activity may exert upon those who supervise or otherwise fund the journalistic efforts. In this country, when the Fairness Doctrine was in operation, the so-called Fairness Doctrine, until Ronald Reagan's administration put it aside, and that was essentially requiring radio, and particularly radio, to give the two sides of every opinion and of every issue. Therefore, you couldn't really have any strong, assertive presentation of an ideologically based point of view unless you got the opposite represented either around the same table or the next night on the same program. That had a great chilling effect upon the managers of radio stations in those days, the pre-Reagan days, so that essentially they avoided allowing controversial issues to be aired.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of looking at it.
And did the same apply up in Canada?
Yeah, I think that's the danger. The danger isn't that a lot of people are going to be pulled into court for writing about controversial issues.
But a lot of publishers will think twice.
Yeah, the danger is you don't have any controversial issues at all. It's like the Fairness Doctrine. There was no talk radio in the Fairness Doctrine
days
because it was too difficult. And if they reintroduced it in the United States now, it would be the same thing. No program director wants to have to micromanage every little minute of the day.
As you know, Mark, they are planning to reintroduce it,
though
in a subtler form.
And if they did succeed in introducing it, it would be the same thing, that people would do non-controversial things. They'd play soft and easy favorites 24 hours a day. And similarly, when I look at the case up, when you look at the price, for example, that Ezra paid for running those Danish cartoons, and you're an editor and you're a publisher, and you've got to make a snap judgment on whether you carry this story, this controversial story, do you really want to take the risk that you're going to have significant six-figure legal bills just fending off?
Well, that's it. The actual price, Ezra, that you paid, I gather, was $100,000 in costs, plus ultimately the death of your magazine.
Well, I mean, our magazine had other challenges that predated this, but it was a distraction. And look, in real court, if we would have won these nuisance suits, we would have had some of our legal costs paid for. That's the Canadian custom. But in this case, no. And it was the imam who activated 15 government bureaucrats and lawyers to prosecute me for 900 days. He could never have afforded that on his own. And when I eventually won, I didn't get any of my costs back. So it's not much of a win. And I salute Mark Stein's Maclean's magazine because they spent even more than I did. They actually had a five-day kangaroo court show trial in Vancouver that they won as well, but they didn't get their cost back either. It's a rare publisher who will spend six figures on a point of principle because at the end of the day, publishers are in the business of making money, and these are tough enough times for the media as it is.
As we were going, as we were going towards the Day of Judgment in Vancouver, we did a program here, as both of you remember, in which we talked about the Stein case in Vancouver before that Human Rights Commission. And among our guests were, I think, the two of you, and as well, was he the publisher, Mark, or the executive editor, or what have you, of Maclean's magazine?
Yeah, there was the publisher is Ken White, who is very supportive, but wasn't there in Vancouver. Andrew Coyne, I think, has been on your show.
Yes, that's who it was, right.
Who was very, but you looked at the big shot lawyers in that room. We were represented by a Queen's Counsel, which is a very expensive form of legal representation in Canada, and if you look at the way, what was interesting about what was going on in that room, the New York Times guy was shocked because, as far as he was concerned, and the New York Times guy isn't some right wing wacko. He was a conventional Times reporter. But he was amazed at how, essentially, in the interests of political correctness and social engineering, every basic principle of the legal system had been precisely inverted on its head. As Ezra says, in this case, it's not the accused who gets his costs paid or who gets legal representation if he's too poor to afford a lawyer. It's the guy bringing the charge against him.
We are overdue for some commercials, way overdue. But let me just make this point as we pause for those commercials. In a way, I think this is part of a larger picture of cultural change. What has happened in both your country and this country, of course, Mark lives in this country and works in this country, but you're still a Canadian citizen, aren't you?
I'm still a subject of the Crown, still a citizen of Canada, and so I regard it as a great as a mark of shame on the Canadian state that in this whole Danish cartoons thing, where people got into trouble about it in France and Britain and Scandinavia and all kinds of other places, but the only country in the Western world to drag a man in front of the state to account for himself. Was Canada and the case of Ezra Levant. And that is a great mark of shame against
Canada. You know, we do it in this country as well. We don't do it to people who, to leading journalists like the two of you, but we do it very often to students at universities. Yeah. I am on the board for the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, FIRE. And the business of FIRE as an organization is to defend students against speech codes,
right,
which dominate in many American universities. I was about to say that in terms of cultural change in both countries, I think we've had in recent years multiculturalism manqué, multiculturalism gone somewhat mad and really perverting and distorting the rights of that should prevail in democratic societies. I put that to you as an hypothesis, and I look for your reaction to that hypothesis directly after these words. And we return directly to Mark Stein, syndicated columnist, specialist in stand-up apocalyptic comedy or apocalyptic commentary, and the author of so much fine work. His last book, America Alone. There's a new book that we need to talk about in a moment. And Ezra Levant, the author of Shakedown, just recently issued, and the subtitle of that book is How Our Government is Undermining Democracy in the Name of Human Rights. Gentlemen, I must confess to you that the first segment, which we've done, lasted for some 15 or 20 minutes. The second segment will last for about a minute and a half. I got myself in a box by going too long on the first one, and we have a newscast coming in just about a minute and a half. But I was putting a little hypothesis before you. Multiculturalism has gone mad and has gone astray, or it's been misused by all sorts of people. Is that part of the problem? Mark Stein.
Yes, I think you when you quoted the example of a college campus south of the border, that's right. If you look at if you take the craziest college campus in America and apply it coast to coast, that is what has happened under the Canadian human rights regime. The worst speech codes at the worst, craziest, kookiest college campus in America. Imagine that applied to society at large. That's what's happened in Canada.
Is it happening in instance plus instance plus instance? Is it there really a kind of a reign of terror now prevailing for free-spoken journalists like the two of you?
Well, not just journalists. In fact, just last week, the Human Rights Commission appealed one of its rare losses. It's going after a former member of parliament for his mailings to his constituents. The mailings were critical of Aboriginal crime, Indian crime in Saskatchewan. The Human Rights Commission said that's inappropriate talk for an MP. They lost the first round. They're not just going after journalists now. Their appetite has grown on what they've eaten.
So if an American congressman writing back to his constituents in Arizona or New Mexico said there's too much crime, too much homicide and violence on the Navajo reservation, he might be subject to similar strictures if he were a Canadian.
That's right, and we have something called parliamentary privilege, which means that politicians are supposed to be immune from lawsuits for what they say.
We have the same, yes.
And it shows the chutzpah of these human rights commissions, appointed political activists who now don't just seek to squelch the news and views, but seek to squelch the views of those who appointed them. And even after my case and Mark Stein's case, they're still at it, Milt.
Even though both of you were, in essence, acquitted or given ultimate clearance.
Yeah, these folks, they're terminators. They will not stop until they're unplugged because they have no reason to stop. In fact, it's an industry, a self-perpetuating industry.
Yeah.
In Canada, 1,000 people make their living in this Human Rights Commission industry. It's a $200 million a year industry. Multiply that by 10 to get the U.S. scale. I mean, imagine if 10,000 people in the States with a $2 billion budget were hunting for offensive speech. They'd find a lot of it if they were paid that well.
Truly scary. And obviously what we've got here, in a way, is bureaucracy gone mad as well. Bureaucracy tends to pursue malign ends, not because they are malignant people, but simply because that's what they do, and that's what they get paid for, and they like to expand the power and the significance of the organizations that they run. We must continue analyzing this new plague that has come upon the Western democracies, and we'll continue to do that right after we pause for an update on this evening's news from Roger Betty. Our guests are both much involved in a kind of violation of free speech rights, violation of basic tenets of democracy up in the neighboring democracy on the north. They are Mark Stein, a well-known syndicated columnist, indeed very active radio guest and occasional radio substitute for another famous, a far more famous talk show host than I am. Indeed, I will say it. The name is Rush Limbaugh. I think you subbed for Rush only about 2 days ago, didn't you, Mark?
Yeah, earlier this week.
And Mark is the author of the book America Alone, and just out, I gather, a book that you put together. It contains various documents titled Lights Out, Stein on Islam, Free Speech, and the Twilight of the West is the subtitle. And Ezra Levant, who talks to us tonight from Calgary, Alberta, is the author of the book Shakedown, which reports his own case that we've been talking about, and many other instances in which essentially opinion, the free expression of opinion, is persecuted and prosecuted by human rights organizations or human rights commissions up in Canada, so as to, in essence, make the expression of free opinion criminal or quasi-criminal, and to get you to stop. One case you talk about in that book, and I think Mark has commented on this as well, is a clergyman, I gather a fundamentalist Christian, who had some condemning things to say about homosexuality, or maybe it was about gay marriage. That's an opinion that would be controversial, but surely in this country, even in this country, clergymen and others are free to express such opinion and free to take their bumps for those who disagree with that opinion and argue against them. But the commission up there in Canada not only fined this guy, but they ordered him never again to speak publicly about homosexuality. Is that right?
Well, not just publicly. For example, he's banned from giving sermons in his church, but the order actually says he can't speak privately about it, even in private emails. That's specifically mentioned in the order, but it's actually worse than that, Milt. I know that sounds just absolutely abominable, but it's worse. He was ordered to make a public renunciation of his beliefs and have a fake apology, a fake letter of contrition run in the local newspaper. So it wasn't just that he has to shut up about his real views. He was compelled by the state to utter false views he did not hold. We call that a jailhouse confession. It's something we associate with the Third World. But he was told, you must renounce your views on gay marriage in the local newspaper. Now, to their credit, the local newspaper said, over our dead body will we publish that propaganda, but the order still stands as a law. Now, it's being appealed, but this guy's poor. I mean,
Is he meanwhile obeying that sanction?
I think he is. I mean, he's actually basically been run out of his job as a pastor. He now works in a different field. I mean, I've met him a few times, and he is a very poor man. I mean, he's not politically equipped like Mark and I to fight back. He's not connected. He doesn't have money. He doesn't have lawyers. He has been bullied and crushed and humiliated. Absolutely. And I've read this judgment so many times because it's so appalling to me. The official view of the Human Rights Commission in Alberta, this was the same one that went after me, by the way, is that the right not to be offended actually trumps freedom of the press and freedom of religion. It's outrageous.
Yeah. Mark, what are some other cases up there these days that help to make the point about this danger to democracy?
Well, I'd just like to add something to what Ezra said on that case. I mean, that is wrong on so many levels, and including, as Ezra said, the fact that a forced confession is the sort of thing we associate with prison states, with totalitarian states. And that is essentially what is going on here, that these are commissions and tribunals that feel very comfortable essentially regulating private opinions. When they're issuing lifetime speech bans, when they're preventing people in personal communications from expressing their views, they have crossed a line. They are well over that line. And as Ezra mentioned, this pastor isn't a wealthy man. He, as I understood it, even when he had this job, he earned, I think, $25,000, $30,000 a year. He doesn't have money for expensive legal representation. Ezra and I were really the first people that these commissions went up against who had the resources, both publicly as sort of semi-public figures, but also the pockets to fight back.
Yeah.
And the reason we did, I think, is because you understand when you look at the judgment in the case in Alberta of that pastor, that these people have become incredibly comfortable with things that would have been outrageous in Canada's legal tradition just 20 or 30 years ago. So you think, where are they going to be in 5 or 10 years? If they're imposing lifetime speech bans now, what are they going to be doing in 5 years' time?
Well, the trouble with both of you is you don't realize that there's a great surge towards the future, which is being enacted through these particular instances of judicial or quasi-judicial limitation and quasi-judicial punishment. Here is the wave of the future. I read it to you. When one makes a revolution, one cannot mark time. One must always go forward or go back. He who now talks about the freedom of the press goes backward and halts our headlong course towards socialism. That is a famous utterance by Vladimir Ilyich Lenin.
Right. And to go back to the quote you used from John Milton and also Salman Rushdie at the beginning of the show, that is why the ability to talk about any issue honestly is a fundamental freedom. Because if you have free speech, you can argue for every other right. If you have free speech, you can argue for your property rights, you can argue for women's rights, you can argue for gay rights, you can argue for other rights you want.
But Mark,
if you don't have free speech, the others don't matter.
Ezra, I once gave a week's lectures up at Carleton University in Ottawa, and I visited the Parliament twice during that week, the imposing parliamentary chamber and those great buildings where the Canadian Parliament sits. It's a democratic parliamentary body of great significance. Aren't they agitated at all about this sort of thing? Isn't there any kind of reaction from within government against this misuse of the commission power?
Well, it's slowly getting onto their radar screen. Just today, a recently retired cabinet minister said he was ashamed that he didn't do more about it. But frankly, it had been kept beneath the radar because, as Mark pointed out, their previous decades worth of victims weren't able to communicate the problem. And this Human Rights Commission, I mean, anything called the Human Rights Commission is going to get by without a lot of scrutiny, because people will say, oh, human rights commissions, those are the good guys.
We're all for human rights, yeah.
Yeah, they won't look past the name. So for 30 years, no one has gone past the name. And it's only been in the last year, a year and a half, that the rock has been turned over and the light has been shone on what's been scurrying around under there.
And another verbal icon, of course, is the very term and the concept of multiculturalism, together with, quote, diversity. And therefore, we must be very, very nice to all those people who aren't like us. We must never say anything critical about them, or we are somehow debasing our democratic compact with all the rest of the world.
Yes, I think there is a side that's very appealing, that somehow the state, just by sort of trimming away at the extremes, can regulate us all into niceness. That's the idea when a lot of the early victims of this system came up, it's true that they're not often the most appealing people. They're people who run, you know, white supremacist websites in the middle of nowhere from their parents' basement that seven people a month mm-hmm. log on to. But the problem with bad laws founded on bad principles is they start at the fringe of society. And they work their way in. And that's why it's important to stand on legal principle. If something's wrong, it's wrong no matter who does it.
Mark,
if you run a red light and you kill someone,
it isn't
better if you're Nelson Mandela and worse if you're a white supremacist. It's wrong to run the red light and kill someone. And that's what this system upturns. It basically selects favored victims and chastises unpreferred.
Mark, you've been in this studio more than once, thus you've been in the Tribune Tower. Did you ever have time to look at the great messages engraved on the walls of the outer lobby of the Tribune Tower?
Yeah, I did, and I must say, say what you like about Colonel McCormick, but the lobby of that building is one of the great sights of Chicago.
And here's something to say about Colonel McCormick. Way back a long time ago, when he was still a rather young man, but had just come into control of this newspaper, there was a little weekly rag published someplace up in Minnesota, which was both anti-Catholic and anti-Semitic. I think it was the Minnesota legislature that punished them and declared them illegal and didn't allow them to publish anymore. And McCormick, with his a prime concern for freedom of the press, using sort of the Voltairean maxim, I despise what you say and I will defend unto the death your right to say it, actually funded a strong counter within the court system of Minnesota, which got them restored as a legitimate, if not very noteworthy or not very admirable, small town publication. And that was celebrated by many others later years as a major victory for freedom of the press.
And that's the right way to look at it. It's that no matter how repugnant somebody may be, and a lot of people don't like Ezra. It's no secret Ezra and I are the most popular people north of the border.
I like both of you considerably.
Yeah, I know you do, Milton. We always get a warm welcome. We get a warmer welcome on your show than we would from the Canadian broadcasting guys in their studios. But that's why it's important to stand on principle. Generally, no matter how bad some rinky-dink white supremacist or anti-Semite or gay basher or whatever it is may be, the state repressing the right to express those opinions is always the worst threat. If there's a bad argument, squash it. Make it socially unacceptable. That's the way you kill bad ideas.
Yeah.
The minute you attempt to criminalize them, as they do up north, a lot of those white supremacist groups think Jews are now a protected category in Canada, and so in effect, all the special protections that the Jewish groups have sought have in effect confirmed all the most absurd conspiracies about the Jews to these white supremacist groups. You kill bad ideas in the light of day through vigorous debate.
The point has never been better made than, indeed, by John Milton. The quotation I used earlier comes, of course, from his great essay, The Areopagitica,
right,
in which, essentially, he lays out the foundational principles for the absolute maintenance of free speech, free press, etc. I think without that work as laid down by British philosophers, beyond Milton, of course, John Stuart Mill and yet others, David Hume for that matter, without all of that, our own founding fathers would not have known how to write the Bill of Rights, and particularly the First Amendment.
Milton, let me just give you a very precise reason why the law is so terrifying. I'm going to quote for you exactly the law that I was charged under, and I think it was the same one in BC that Mark was charged under. Mm-hmm. I mean, as I say this, imagine how many days a week you personally would violate this law. In Canada, it is an offense to publish anything that, quote, is likely to expose a person to hatred or contempt. Yeah. Unquote. Likely to. That's maybe. That's future tense. That it might be. It might be what? Expose a person to feelings of hatred. Not punch someone in the nose, not hurt them or harm them any real way, but expose them to some feeling. It's such a vague law, Milt, that it must be political because you could literally apply that to anyone saying anything anytime.
That is very much like what happens on many American campuses with regard to their speech requirements or their speech codes. And FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, is constantly firing shots across the bows of the presidential vessels at those universities, making clear that this is a violation of First Amendment rights. However, of course, private universities can, if they choose, if they don't get any federal funding, which is a rare instance, to be sure, they can go ahead and violate the First Amendment within their institutional confines.
I know of no such university in Canada that doesn't get funding from the government. We have speech codes in Canada, but it's worse because these human rights commissions are government agencies to begin with, and they have awesome powers. Look, the worst thing that could happen to you on a campus is you're kicked off. And I know that's terrible for the person involved, but that's not the same as being jailed or fined or subjected to a court order. There was a fella in Canada who did 9 months in jail because he wouldn't stop hurting people's feelings. 9 months in jail. I know of cases of rapists serving longer jail sentences. So that's the difference. Speech codes on campuses are awful, they're immoral, and they're contrary to intellectual freedom that universities should be a bastion of. But these human rights commissions that have the force of the law and punishment behind them are terrifying. But there are human rights commissions in the States, too. I mean, for example, the city of Philadelphia has a 33-person human relations commission with a multi-million dollar budget, and a year ago they prosecuted Gino's Steakhouse, which is sort of a famous tourist attraction, with the Philly cheesesteaks, because they had a sign that said, you're in America, please speak English, please order in English. Now, that might or might not be offensive to Hispanics or to others, but for them to be prosecuted by the state, so it's creeping out of the university campuses and into regular life in the States. Now, Gino's beat the rap.
I would say that this is actually probably epidemic or pandemic around the Western supposedly democratic world. Don't we find similar instances in the UK and, for that matter, in continental Western Europe?
Yes, I think it's clear that if you look at Western Europe, I take the view that America has the strongest protections of speech with the First Amendment. Next, traditionally, have been what we call the British Commonwealth countries, Canada, Britain, Australia, that have robust traditions of free speech deriving from Milton, and in fact going back further than that. They don't formalize it in First Amendment form, but they have strong tradition. Generally speaking, continental Europe, because of its particular history, has been more comfortable in regulating free speech and expression. And we see that where essentially Geert Wilders in the Netherlands, he's a parliamentarian who made a short film about Islam, and the Dutch courts are now prosecuting him. The United Kingdom declared him persona non grata. We've seen, I think, a fairly shameful public apology from the Danish Prime Minister, the one who's about to become Secretary General of NATO, fixing himself with the Muslim world by prostrating himself and apologizing for the Danish cartoons. These are things that should not be the matter of politicians or of courts. These are things that citizens should be able to reach their own judgments on. In some of the oldest nation states on the planet, you should not have courts regulating opinion and regulating free expression. And Western governments are too comfortable with
it. I must tell both of you that, once again, you've got me in trouble. I'm so involved in and so pleased with what you're saying that I'm running very late, not meeting my obligations. Therefore, we pause instantly for an update, or rather for a quick round of commercials, and only a few minutes later, we take care of the news. But we will then return to Mark Stein and Ezra Levant after this. And directly back to Mark Stein in New Hampshire at the moment, and to Ezra Levant up in Calgary in Alberta. And Mark, you are, of course, a great, among the many things you do so well, you're a great expert on and a great lover of popular music, and you write about it very brilliantly. I remind you of something you know better than I do, I'm sure, namely the libretto of The Sound of Music. Is that a Rodgers and Hammerstein thing? I guess
that's
it must
right,
be.
That's right, it is, yeah.
And Julie Andrews in the film version sings, "These are some of my favorite things." What they don't let us sing anymore is, these are some of my least favorite things, or these are some of my least favorite people. It becomes essentially a great intimidation worked upon all of us by such agencies as we've been talking about, and even by the general cultural air around us now. It becomes an intimidation against us, directly expressing disdain and distaste for anything.
Yes, and I think the minute you have laws predicated on what some people find offensive, that's not a legal concept. If somebody goes to a state bureaucrat and complains that I've offended him, I can't defend myself against that. Essentially, he's right. I'm guilty because offensiveness is in the eye of the offended. There is no legal argument against that. It's an emotion. And that's why you shouldn't have legal systems that are built around human emotions. If someone has a problem with Ezra's magazine or with my book, the thing to do is start your own magazine, publish your own book, or go on the internet and start a blog. You argue against it. You don't drag in bureaucrats from the state to tie your enemies up in paperwork and legal expenses and court cases for 2, 3, 4 years simply as a means of punishing them. And that is what is wrong. When you criminalize opinion, you put yourself on a slippery slope where the skids are greased very fast and you descend very quickly.
And indeed, it threatens the very maintenance of a serious and committed democracy, it seems to me. Nothing less than that.
There is a proper response to racism and bigotry and comments that are beyond the pale, but they're all personal or social, almost peer pressure is the phrase I would use. If someone's rude, you can ignore him, or you can marginalize him. Don't invite him over for dinner.
Or you can argue against him.
That's right. And all of these mean that someone will indeed face the consequences if they do say something offensive, but none of them destroy someone's property rights or freedom like these awful human rights commissions do. None of them have the power to fine or imprison people. And, you know, if it's, in a way, it's outsourcing our personal responsibility to the government when we expect some nanny state agency to run after every offensive thing. I mean, if something's bothering you, if someone's telling a rude joke at the office, deal with it personally. Don't call 911.
Gentlemen, I fully agree, of course. That little signal tells us it's 10 o'clock. We return directly to Mark Stein and to Ezra Levant after the update on the news from Roger Bettish. And we return directly to Mark Stein, syndicated columnist, all-around commentator on history, modern history, public affairs, not to mention the world of entertainment and great writing on popular music, is with us from near his home up in New England. And with us from Calgary is Ezra Levant. And we've taken as the text for the evening, though I haven't given full attention to it, this excellent and important new book by Ezra Levant titled Shakedown. And indeed, the foreword or introduction to the book is written by, of all people, Mark Stein. I want to say a word to our listeners. If you have something to report by way of standards of against hate speech, having been so-called hate speech, having been imposed upon you, and for that matter, if you've been urged to develop, quote, more multicultural sensitivity, and whether those comments have come merely from personal acquaintances, or whether they've come from representatives of the institutions with which you are affiliated. We'd love to have some further case histories reported to us, if only rather briefly. Or if you've got opinions or questions about the matters under discussion tonight, do by all means give us a ring. Number for any and all such calls is, as ever, 591-7200. The area code 312, then 591-7200. If you want to reach us via email, and that's particularly appropriate for people at a great distance, then the email address is extension 720 at tribune.com. Extension 720 as one word at tribune.com. And gentlemen, I told you I've got some emails from Australia, and let me read them to you. One from Ruth, who identifies herself as having been born in Canada and now living in Australia. She says the following: I am in Brisbane, Australia, listening to Ezra Levant and Mark Stein on this very important topic. I've been following this issue for some time. Thank you so much for devoting the airtime. We thank you for listening. And now to Mike, an old friend of ours who listens quite regularly in Sydney, and who says the following: Only a few years ago, two pastors in the state of Victoria were fined and faced an extended jail sentence for, quote, criticizing Islam. One of the pastors, a convert from Islam to Christianity, had merely quoted from the Quran during his sermon and did that without commentary, and this was deemed, quote, hate speech. Yet the local TV networks never face a prosecution for airing critical programs about the Judeo-Christian accounts. I was explosive with anger at the time. Thank you for having Messrs. Levant and Stein. This topic can never be allowed to become stale. So, more instances. It's all over the Commonwealth, apparently, in Australia as well as in Canada. And I suppose it must be true even in, in Kenya, which is still a member of the Commonwealth, I believe, is it not?
It certainly is. That Australian case down in Victoria was very interesting. As I understand it, the judgment came up before the Court of Appeal, which struck it down. But the point is to teach the larger lesson. For those two pastors, the lesson is that to resist it will cost you a fortune and will take up years of your time. So it's better to submit. In Saskatchewan, a couple of years ago, a guy took out an advertisement in the Saskatoon Star Phoenix, not quoting the biblical injunctions against homosexuality, but just referencing the relevant, just basically putting the relevant chapter and verse of Leviticus and Romans. He didn't actually say what was in, but if you were curious enough, you could go to Leviticus or Romans and read what it says about homosexuality. The Human Rights Commission ruled that that was a hate crime, and they found the guy guilty. That was eventually appealed to the Court of Appeals in Saskatchewan. But the reality is that that guy could not place that advertisement in the Saskatoon Star Phoenix today because the newspaper wouldn't want the trouble. They wouldn't want the hassle.
That's that chilling effect I spoke of earlier.
Yeah, yes. So in effect, the space for public discourse has shriveled. The appeals court decision 5, 10, 15 years down the road is irrelevant. In practical terms, the speech, in practical terms, the limits of free speech in Saskatchewan, as in Victoria down in Australia, have shriveled. And this is disastrous for free society.
Now, here's my challenge to both of you. I was tending towards this before. Now I want to put it as a straight question. Being the sociologue that I am, or the amateur historicist, if not historian, I look for ultimate or quasi-ultimate sources. What has been happening in our Western societies to advance this whole anti-democratic process in this direction? How do we really explain that we've come upon this problem in the Western world generally?
Part of it is, I think, our Western hospitality. I mean, let me make a strange reference, but I hope you'll get where I'm coming from. The movie Borat, a vulgar comedy, but hilarious in a way, was about this buffoon who went throughout America doing cringeworthy things, and it showed how Americans were so tolerant of a foreigner, so tolerant of an insulting foreigner that that they bit their tongues and were polite and just say, oh, that's not how we do things here. To me, that was the story of Borat. at, is Americans will bend over backwards not to offend anyone. But the trouble is some people are coming here not offending by accident, but offending on purpose. They want to change us. They want Sharia law here. So we're confusing our natural goodwill and good faith and hospitality, and I'm speaking as a Canadian in the same way, with a law that must make us silent when someone does something wrong. And it's actually the soft bigotry of low expectations, because, look, if it weren't a radical Muslim who had taken me and Mark Stein to human rights court, if it was a Catholic priest, there would have been no chance it would have gone anywhere, because we North Americans are so used to the separation of church and state, but we're not used to the separation of mosque and state. We're not used to pushing for that because we're so afraid we'll be called racist or inhospitable or unfriendly. And what's happening is we're blurring a friendliness with what our friend Kathy Schadl calls a tyranny of nice, where we're forced to be nice, we're forced to shut up, we're forced to say nothing as the Borats of the world invade. I don't know if you catch my point there, but there's a blurry line that the state is crossing between being nice on our own accord and being forced to be nice.
You know, it occurs to me that a similar standard applies even in elementary schools, where when the kids play games, you no longer have winners and losers, because for somebody to be designated as a loser is to hurt his feelings, the poor, sensitive little 7-year-old. And therefore, the tyranny of nice applies even there.
Yes, I think that's true, actually. I think, in a sense, it's infected our entire culture, right down to grade school and kindergarten. We have this thing called sensitivity training.
Exactly.
Now that a lot of your listeners will have found themselves forced to undergo for one infraction or another. And Kathy Schadl, whom Ezra mentioned a moment ago, she used the marvelous phrase that what we actually need is insensitivity training.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's right, that if you have multicultural societies where people from different religious backgrounds, different racial and cultural backgrounds, are all jostling together in the same apartment house or the same cul-de-sac, it's better to actually encourage them to develop thicker skins rather than to create a legal system which rewards them for taking offense at the slightest thing.
Mark, what do you have to add to what Ezra said when it comes to the search for ultimate explanations?
Well, you know, I think there was a period, really in the 60s and 70s, when we thought that all the great questions had been settled. I think after the Second World War, certainly in Europe, they didn't trust their citizens quite the way they had, because people like Hitler and Mussolini had been incredibly popular. So it seemed natural, once things had settled down, to say, well, we're not in favor of this and we're not in favor of that. But don't worry, we're still free societies. We're just chipping away a few people out on the extremist fringe. And you don't really have to worry about them. We're taking... We are still liberal societies, but we're engaging in illiberal acts on the road to ever greater perfection. And I think that was very dangerous. I don't believe in these laws against Holocaust denial that they have in Europe. I don't believe in the prosecutions that there've been in Canada for people who've claimed that the Holocaust happened. I think you ridicule that, you mock it. I think a guy like Mel Brooks doing Springtime for Hitler does far more good to discredit anti-Semitism
yeah.
than a lot of stupid laws do. But I think at that time people told themselves it's okay because it's just a bit of sort of historical mopping up on the way to utopia.
Yeah.
And as you said earlier, if you create a bureaucracy whose livelihood depends on campaigning against hate, if you've got essentially a non-hateful society, which is what Canada is, they'll start defining hate to ever more widely in an effort just to justify their vast bureaucracy.
Gentlemen, it's time to go to the phones. Let's do that right now. We've got a call from Roy up in Toronto. And good evening, sir. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. I just wanted to say hello to Ezra and Mark Stein, who are two of my heroes. What they say is completely true. This kind of thing, and they haven't even given the more crazy versions of these things. There was a guy in Quebec whose name is Al Haiti, who wrote a book basically saying that gay people should be beheaded and various other anti-Semitic and anti-Western things. Someone made a complaint to the Human Rights Commission, and it was rejected because it seems to be okay if you're a Muslim and can, and say those kind of things. So these commissions are not only very selective in who it is they prosecute, but who it is that can make the complaints in the first place.
Fascinating revelation. Do either of you know about that particular case?
I do. I mean, he's a convert to Islam. He's called Al-Haiti because he's from Haiti.
Ah.
And he doesn't just spew offensive words. He actually calls for the murder of people. And, I mean, I draw the line. I mean, I think people can be full of hate. We don't like that, but that shouldn't be criminalized. But this fellow went far beyond hate. He went into calls for death and kill Jews, kill gays, kill uncovered women. You would think that that would certainly trip the wire of a hate speech commission, but no. In the history, in the 32-year history of the Canadian Human Rights Commission, they have never prosecuted anyone other than a white Christian. And I'm not saying white Christians are immune from quote hate,
or a white or a white Jew. You are Jewish, aren't you?
That's right. Now it was the, I was in the Alberta Human Rights Commission. They went after me, but. The fact that they are so particular in what ethnic groups get a pass and which ones don't shows that it's not actually the rule of law, but it's a political power play.
Very significant. Yes, sir.
Ezra makes a good point there. We all know the reality of the situation, that the resurgent anti-Semitism in the Western world today does not derive from knuckle-dragging neo-Nazi skinheads. It comes from quite another source. The human rights commissions in Canada are cowards on that, cowards. I spoke to the Ontario Parliament a couple of weeks ago, and I told a feminist MP who'd asked me this question about women's rights that essentially they've accepted a two-tier sisterhood. If you're a woman from a traditional background, an ethnic European post-Christian background, you're entitled to full women's rights. If you come from a Muslim background, you can be forced into marriage. As we saw in Toronto, you can be the victim of an honor killing, and the human rights apparatus has nothing to say about it. And the pathetic woman who runs the Ontario Human Rights Commission said, oh, well, we can't deal with everything. We have to prioritize. So their priority is not honor killings of Muslim teenage girls in Toronto, but stupid cases about a preoperative transsexual who wants to use the ladies' shower in an Ontario health club. They go after small businessmen, they go after Christian pastors, but they're too gutless and too cowardly to deal with real serious sources of hate in Canadian society.
It's a variant of épater les bourgeois, I think. Go to the respectable ones that who annoy you for the fact that they are central in our social system, and favor those who are outliers. We are overdue for a round of commercials. Our thanks to the caller from Toronto. And if you want to call us, some lines are now available. 591-7200, 591-7200, 312, the area code. If you want to reach us via email, the email address, extension 720 at tribune.com. Write back to your contributions, whether in the form of questions or information, after we pause for this. And directly back to Mark Stein and to Ezra Levant. We're getting a good deal from the Commonwealth. Here's another from Canada, gentlemen. Greetings from Vancouver, home of the 2010 Olympics, but also home of the despicable BC Human Rights Commission. Thank you so much for having Mark Stein and Ezra Levant on your show. I have very few heroes anymore, but they are definitely two of them. I have a question especially for Mark. My sense is that many elements within the Democratic Party view the U.S. Constitution more as a, quote, suggestion than anything else. Whenever I tell my American friends about the craziness going on up here in Kadukistan, I hadn't heard that before, Kadukistan, they always talk about their unalterable right to free speech. I wonder, would you ask Mark to speculate on how the Obama administration might fiddle with free speech rights of Americans?
Well, I think what is interesting here is if you look at the international picture, that, for example, the Canadian Islamic Congress, the The organization of the Islamic Conference, which is the 58 Muslim nations around the world, has had great success in effectively getting the United Nations to support a group defamation right against Islam. Now, what's interesting to me is that when you look at the judicial nominees that the Obama administration is proposing, they are people who, like Harold Coe, for example, who's currently going through the nomination process, he is someone who thinks that the United States Constitution should, in effect, be made more compatible with international norms on international law. That is a very disturbing trend to me. And in the end, there is, I think, a question mark over whether the First Amendment could survive a serious, determined assault on it by transnational progressives like Mr. Coe, who think effectively that the United States should be brought into line with Canada and much of the rest of the world on these issues. I often use that image of Sir Edward Grey, the British Foreign Secretary on the eve of the First World War, who looked out of his window in August 1914 and said, the lamps are going out all over Europe. The lamps of liberty are gradually being extinguished around the world, and the idea that the United States could survive as the lone beacon and the exception to the norms of the rest of the planet, I think is very dubious.
You know, how curious, Mark, before the two of you joined us, when I did the pre-introduction to the program, which we do at 9 o'clock, and then we take a newscast and then we begin, I used the very same metaphor about the lights going out around the world. I said lights rather than lamps, but I had the same quotation in mind.
I think they were gas lamps in Edward Grey's day.
I suppose they were, yes.
Lights works just as well.
Let's go to another caller quickly, 591-7200, and to Fred in Merrillville, Indiana. Good evening, sir.
Good evening, gentlemen. Fascinating program. When you were asking for examples of how multiculturalism or diversity has filtered its way down into American society, I would say there's no place that is happening more rampantly and with more frequency than in the American education system.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an elementary education major at one of the universities here in Northwest Indiana, and they cram it down your throat. I mean, I'm like you, Milt. I'm a very conservative individual brought up with some very specific values and morals, and they're so worried about labels and about equality and fairness for everyone that they lose sight of what they're doing to the children. And even in some of my observations in the classroom, like you said, there are no winners and losers anymore. School used to be about competition and striving to be the best, and now they want everyone to be, you know, there is no more challenging, there is no more, everyone gets a trophy, everyone, you know, is made to feel like, I agree that we need to build our children's self-esteem, but if we don't teach them about how to succeed through failure and how to work harder to achieve what you want, when they get out into the real world, they're going to find that the world is not as forgiving and not as accepting as what they're trying to portray in the school systems. And these kids are where mediocrity or below average is okay are going to flounder in the real world.
Very important contribution, gentlemen. Your response.
Well, look, there are other values out there. Like politeness and being kind to those who are weaker or dumber. But there are certain areas of endeavor where those values have to come second, to truth, for example, or to freedom. And whether it's in school, where I think getting the right answer and learning in gym, let's say, competing, that should come first, and maybe politeness should come second. In publishing, freedom of speech should come first, and maybe multicultural sensitivity should come second. I'm not saying that those other values are worthless. They are, but they should not be the first order values. I think we should actually try and get along with Islam, but we should not subvert our own values to do so. And that's the problem here, is that is that ideas like truth and freedom are being made equal or even subordinate to, you know, elective values like being polite.
Yeah, I'd agree with Ezra that I think you have to, any society has to be able to live in truth. And so it's very dangerous when the state decides it wants to, in effect, erect a fiction. There are certain societies in the world that are more successful than others by certain objective measures. If you take, for example, GDP per capita in nations with over 20 million people, the top four in the world are the United States, Canada, Australia, and the United Kingdom. Now, there's nothing terribly diverse about that quartet of countries. They arise from a relatively narrow tradition when you look at all the different kinds of societies there are all over the planet. But nevertheless, it's a fact that when it comes in terms of delivering individual prosperity to large numbers of people, those four happen to do it better than anyone else. And so when you teach children, when you say that in the interests of not hurting anybody's feelings, you teach children essentially fictions, I think you are putting a society on a very dangerous path. And the one thing I would say about the United States is that if you look at some of the sort of the nice fluffy marshmallow things that children are told in grade one or grade two, and then try to imagine what it's like north of the border, those fictions are enforced by state bureaucrats with huge powers. That's eventually where this leads. You know, we ought to be able to talk about things objectively, and we ought to be able to prioritize the truth.
Gentlemen, we pause once again. Our thanks to that caller, and we'll be directly back after an update on the news for that to the newsroom and Roger Battish. And we return directly to Mark Stein and to Ezra Levant. And Mark, I mentioned earlier the title of a new book. I gather some of your writing and some other things that you've reproduced in the book Lights Out. I have not yet seen it, but tell us what it's about.
No, I basically decided to take the dossier of my writing that the Canadian Islamic Congress had compiled and filed with the Human Rights Commission. And when I read all these terrible pieces that they cited as flagrant Islamophobia of mine, I thought, actually, you know, some of these ones hold up pretty well. And I thought it would be nice to have all my flagrantly Islamophobic writing all in one convenient place. So I put all these in one book, and I provided some additional commentary responding to the accusations made about me in the course of the last year.
Well, let us now deal with that. Are you, sir, in fact, an Islamophobe, or if not, what are you?
I'm not Islamophobic, and I don't like those terms. I don't like the term homophobia because I think it's a way of making what are essentially political differences into a kind of mental illness. You know, if you say, I don't believe in gay marriage, and the other guy says, you're homophobic then, it's his way of saying, I don't need to have an argument, I don't need to have a discussion with you because you're just mentally ill. So I reject.
You know what it is, in fact, is the argument ad hominem in modern form.
And I've got no time for that. But also because I was inspired by Ezra when this thing began. I had lunch shortly after my own troubles began in Montreal with an old and very prominent journalist friend of mine, and he said, you know, just play it cool, take it easy, don't make a big fuss about this, and the court process will work its way through, and then it will all be over. And then I spoke to Ezra, and I realized, no, Ezra has got the right idea. Ezra decided he was going to go nuclear, he was going to fight back, he was going to push back hard. And Ezra's example really did more than anything else, I think, to change the terms of the debate in Canada. So I thought, given the fact that these the thugs of the Canadian Islamic Congress had in effect tried to criminalize my writing, I owed it to the battle for free speech to make sure that these writings will now be preserved in hardcovers forever. And that's simply the level of pushback that I'm committed to, and I got that from Ezra. Ezra is one of these people have strong views on. I often say he's a bit like one of these shower settings where you give it the merest nudge and it suddenly turns scalding. Ezra went scalding, Ezra went nuclear, and he took these disgusting commissions that have been doing their work in the dark for 30 years and expose them to the light of day. It requires enormous personal energy and personal commitment to do what he did. And I think far too few of us in the media have given him the backing that he deserves for that crusade.
Actually, Ezra, I've just learned that you videoed, by reading your book, I've just learned that you videoed your presentation before the commission and that it's been available on YouTube. Is it still?
It is, and that's what sort of sparked the national fight back because, I mean, the idea of a journalist being summoned downtown to answer questions from a government agent for 90 minutes is so contrary to our ideas of who we are as free people. That's something that you expect from China or the former Soviet Union or, like I joke, a Saturday Night Live skit. But for Canadians and Americans to actually see it was stunning. If you turn the volume off, couldn't be more boring, three people sitting in a lawyer's office. But with the sound on and to hear a government agent say, what were your intentions behind publishing that? What are your political views? That's so un-Canadian. It's not just un-American. It's un-Canadian. And
you should have answered none of your damn business, did you?
I said the word bloody instead of damn. Said, it's my right to publish whatever the hell I like, no matter what the hell you... Trying so hard not to swear, Milt. I was so mad that I was there, and my lawyer was sitting next to me. It was like he made me do my Zen exercises beforehand because he knew how mad I was. But I think the anger comes through anyways, and 700,000 people have watched that clip.
Oh, my goodness.
And I'm glad because if I didn't bring my video camera in there, I don't think anyone would believe me of what was said and done. And that elicited enormous feedback, especially from the States. I should say in the early days, at least half of my supporters were from the United States, not just the moral support, but to help me cover my legal bills. Half the dough came from Americans, Milt, and that was so amazingly encouraging to me.
We've got reason to be very concerned down here, and the Canadian example in extremis is one that ought to really chasten us and bring us to attention. We go back to the phones, gentlemen. Here is the next caller, Patrick, in the suburban Chicago. Good evening.
Good evening. Hey, Milt, I just want to say, first of all, that I love your show. I listen to it quite often when I drive home in my car. I have a half-an-hour drive, so I really appreciate it. You know, I just wanted to comment. I'm a pastor in the northwest suburbs. I just did a three-week series contrasting Christianity with various different religions in the world. And taking into account the different cultures and the beauty that's in the cultures, but contrasting the ideas. And it's kind of ironic at the same time that this commission in the UN passed a resolution that you can't speak anything about other religions. And the only religion that seemingly was named was Islam. And I just feel that, you know, the world as a whole is giving in to Islam. And you can go on YouTube and see many Islamic preachers preach against all different kinds of religions, and yet they're asking other people basically not to say a thing. And I really feel that true freedom comes when there's a multitude of ideas put forward where people can decide for themselves. But if the government tells you what you can and cannot say, then we're just not a free people. And I think it goes beyond freedom of speech. I think it goes even to the point where just a judge today in Illinois shot down the law saying that pharmacies or pharmacists have to suppress their own conscience in giving out medication that's against their conscience. And I feel that it's not just in one area, it's in many areas that government is infringing on people's right to be free.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, Milt, that one of the things that is great about the common law tradition is it isn't big on group rights. And that action at the UN, where essentially it sowed the seed for a kind of group defamation protection for a religion, I think that takes us into very perilous waters. If you believe, if you're a Muslim, then Islam is the truth, and it's your faith, and you believe in it absolutely, just as if you're a Jew or a Catholic or whatever. But if you're not a believer in that religion, then religion is an ideology. It's a set of ideas. And if you don't subscribe to that set of ideas, you should be able to discuss it and talk about it. And one of the great strengths of common law, the common law tradition of America and Canada and other countries, is that it understands that the ultimate minority is the individual. And that if you treat all individuals equally in society, you will have a free society. But if you accord certain groups different rights, and you start dealing in group rights, and you require the state to be the only arbiter between these different groups, you are on a path to a kind of managed, soft tyranny that will become a much harder tyranny very, very quickly.
Well said, of course, and I thank the caller for that. And let me read you another email I've got in front of me. Again, we've got a Canadian responding. I am a Canadian JD student finishing my final semester on exchange at an American university. I wanted to first thank Ezra for standing up so courageously and vocally for Canadian values. Indeed, I am thankful that someone has remembered that Canada does have values worthy of protection. It is refreshing and very encouraging. I recently took a Canadian human rights class and was very dismayed to discover that many endorse the state using law as an instrument to regulate people's feelings and thoughts. I am worried that this has been so normalized that returning to our root values will be a real challenge. I was hoping that Ezra and Mark may offer some suggestions about what Canadians can do to denormalize this raw normal and take back rights that have been lost. I read that wrong. To denormalize this new normal and take back rights that have been lost. Additionally, has Ezra been invited to speak at any Canadian law schools? Signed by Jennifer. Ezra.
Well, I haven't. In fact, I have been invited to speak at a law school on my book tour. I'll announce it on my blog when it's firmed up. I have been invited to speak in the last few months at a great many legal seminars very reputable, which has been so amazing to me because a year ago, Milt, I would have called myself a radical way out there by myself with Mark Stein and a few other friends. But now I've frankly been invited to some amazing institutions. I even was invited to testify before the U.S. Congress's bipartisan Human Rights Caucus. And just for a little kid from Calgary, that's quite something. My point is, denormalization is a great word that your correspondent uses because censorship is not normal. Even though we've been told by our betters it is normal, it's not. And if you peel back the euphemisms of political correctness and you get people speaking frankly, they're mad about this stuff. And so just by being persistent and laying out my case day after day, I have been able to normalize, again, freedom of speech. I should say we. Hundreds of bloggers and more mainstream journalists too, and Mark Stein at his five-day show trial. And so we've been able to normalize free speech and denormalize these human rights commissions to the point where we now see a few politicians in Canada finally talking about reform. And it comes down to that discussion Mark had with his friend in Montreal a couple of years ago. Do we sit back quietly while the bad guys say, no, this is Canada, this is America, it is a censorious place where you must guard your words for fear of prosecution? Do we sit back and allow that to be the new normal? Or do we stand up and say, hell no, I am normal. Speaking my mind is normal. Even if I'm rude, that's my right. What's abnormal is a government that wants to censor me. And it's basically not letting the other side get the moral high ground. That's what we have to do. It's a psychological thing we have to come to terms with, that we're going to be dissidents until stand up until the other side is the marginalized side.
Ezra, a very particular question. If I have it this right, you once yielded a nomination to Parliament to Stephen Harper, who became ultimately the Canadian Prime Minister. Is that right?
That's right. And I should say,
Have you talked with him? What does he have to say about these matters?
I'm going to keep my conversations with him private, if I may. But I should say that two weeks ago, I made a personal visit to 24 Sussex Drive. That's our equivalent to the White House.
Mm-hmm.
And I dropped off a book and personally signed it to Stephen and Lorraine Harper. And at dinner, and Lorene and Stephen, I've known them both for quite some time, and I'm gently prodding them behind the scenes. I don't want to tell tales out of school, but I'm trying to do both, be a noisy guy in public and privately talk to some of my friends in politics, because, Milt, I actually want to get this done. And even though I was acquitted back in August of my offenses, I haven't given up the fight because the problem is still out there. And I want to finish the job. So I want to see reforms in political circles. And the Prime Minister in Canada is in a tough spot right now because he's got a minority government that might fall at any time. But I want to steal his spine and give him some encouragement to let him know it's safe to come out and repeal these laws.
Excellent. Gentlemen, the last round of commercials beckons, and then directly back to the phones and to the email, and all of that to follow right after this. And directly back to our listeners, and in this case, to the phones and to Jan here in Chicago. Good evening.
Yes, good evening. Very interesting program as usual. This is all going also into history. We're cleaning up history. For World War II, I've noticed that we no longer speak about the Germans, and I think we're all the same age. We must have all played GIs versus Germans, but now all of a sudden it's the word Nazi. And I've asked people, why do you use Nazi? He says, oh, it represents the party that was in charge in Germany at the time, so it means the same thing. Well, according to that logic, earlier Mr. Stein said that the Canadians and the Americans landed at the beaches in Europe. Maybe he should say that the Democrats and the Tories landed on the beaches at Normandy.
Yes, nice point.
Yeah, I think that's true. If you look at Germany, what's very interesting to me about that particular example is that in the 1920s, the Weimar Republic, in fact, had all the kind of speech codes that they have up in Canada. The Nazi Party was prosecuted in the 1920s for anti-Semitic speech. Hitler was banned at one point from giving speeches because of his anti-Semitism. There were strong speech codes in the Weimar Republic, and as we saw, they did absolutely nothing to prevent Hitler coming to power. And what happened when he took power was that he used all those restrictions on speech against his enemies. That's why this idea that all these nice laws criminalizing people you don't like will only be used against the bad people in society. It's completely ridiculous. They're useless for dealing with the real bad people. But if bad people get hold of those laws, they'll use them against you.
Our thanks to the caller. Let's move rather quickly. Time being short, and lots of people still online. And here is the next Kevin in Chicago. Good evening.
Yes, hello. I'm in Chicago now, but I also live about half the time in the Dominican Republic, and it seems to me that the issues of hate speech do come down to what's considered polite in society, and I'm often struck as I'm going around in Dominican society at how different it is, in that they'll often use words like moreno or hey negro or hey chino, which would be saying hey darky or hey Chinaman, and it's something that, of course, we'd never do in the United States. It's a totally different way of looking at how people are addressed. And so I guess my question would be, as we're opening up to different concepts, how far would we be willing to go to protect speech which we would then consider impolite?
Well, and that's the thing, is it's a matter of taste, isn't it? And a matter of fashion, and a word that is politically acceptable 20 years ago might not be the same today or in 20 years. And to give these very subjective ideas into the hands of the state is bizarre. Let me talk for a minute about Mark Stein's trial. I sat in that courthouse for a few days in Vancouver while three political appointees and their so-called experts pored over line by line Mark Stein's column in a magazine, to poke and prod each word to see if it was fair by their particular taste.
And whether it was hurtful, I guess.
Yeah, well, and who the heck are they? I mean, and as I like to say, if William Shakespeare himself came back from the dead and gave an opinion on the legality of my writing, I wouldn't listen to him. I would be very interested if he had something to say to me man to man, but if he all of a sudden had the power of a censor, I wouldn't care what he said. Last point, in Vancouver, the same Human Rights Commission that tried Mark Stein this fall is trying a comedian who said some insulting comments about some hecklers who happened to be lesbian. He made, told some jokes about them that probably weren't very funny, but the government's now going to have a trial. The Human Rights Commission is going to have a trial as to whether or not those jokes were funny.
Well, you remember, that reminds one, as a matter of fact, with thanks to that caller, reminds one of some significant trials that were occurred, I think, here in Chicago quite a long time ago, of a stand-up comic of who was rather abrasive and rather challenged or stretched the limits, namely Lenny Bruce, who was put on trial for, I'm not sure what the exact trial was, but for being vulgar in public, essentially. And they tried to take away his license and otherwise punish him. And indeed, they succeeded, I guess.
And to go back to that word that your caller used, you know, at what point do we restrict impolite speech? I mean, to frame it in those terms, I think, is very dangerous. If you're in a bar and someone says something, quote, impolite, you say to him, hey, man, you are way out of line. I don't want you to say that again. Mm-hmm. And then if he wants to push it and you want to threaten to take it outside into the parking lot, that's a healthier reaction than giving bureaucrats and judges the power to determine which words are good and which words are bad.
Which ones are hurtful. You know what occurs to me? A title suddenly popped into mind. You know this book. Philip Reif's work of so many years ago, The Triumph of the Therapeutic. We live in a society in which the therapeutic has really triumphed and dominates, and we're supposed to be responsible for the hemi-demi-semi-quavers of sensitive feeling on the part of those that we deal with.
Right, right. And that's what we're dealing with. Well, it's either the underlying, it's not even the hemi-demi-semi-quavers, it's basically the underlying harmony. I mean, Ezra mentioned that what was the weirdest day in my trial was the day they devoted to going over the so-called, quote, tone, unquote, of my jokes.
Huh.
Now, that would be a very arcane piece if it ran in the Literary Review of Canada. But when you've actually got judges and expert witnesses going over it, as Ezra was talking about there, that is a society that is badly out of whack. And neither those judges nor those expert witnesses should be in that business.
Gentlemen, we are approaching the end. We've only got about 3 minutes left. I mean merely the end of the program, not ultimate apocalypse. Apologies to those who are still waiting online. But a general question with not enough time to respond to it, and it's too broad a question. All the same, I can't resist. How do you fit all of this that we've been discussing into the larger tempo of this time? What else, in what historical process does this belong?
I yield to Mark because I know he has a broader view of this.
He thinks in those terms, to be sure.
Well, I do think it is part of what we call a general, what we would see as a general faint-heartedness in the West. That we don't understand that the legal tradition, among other things, is a very rare inheritance, a very precious inheritance, particular to a relatively small number of societies around the world. And the vandalism that is done to it in the interests of political correctness and social engineering, we think we can afford to do that because, in a sense, we are so successful, we think we can chip away and damage the foundations of our own society, and they're strong enough to withstand it all. I think in the cases that Ezra and I have been involved in, you see, in fact, how fragile and how vulnerable these things are, and that's why it's important to stand for core principles like freedom of speech. I didn't think in the year 2009 that I would be having to make the case for freedom of speech in one of the oldest settled democracies on the planet. And the fact that Ezra and I have to fight this fight in Canada it speaks very poorly for Canada, and is a good glimpse of the peril that some of these core values are in some of the oldest free societies in the world.
We are just about out of time. I am most grateful to the two of you for joining us. Let's make very clear that the new book by Ezra Levant is titled Shakedown and is just published by McClelland and Stewart. That's a Canadian publisher, is it not?
That's right.
But available certainly in this country. And the book of 2 years ago by Mark Stein, very, very important book utterly relevant to this present moment, as it was certainly 2 years ago, is America Alone, and now more recently, one that I have not yet seen, but I gather it's a collection then of some of the major articles on these matters, on Islam, essentially, by Mark Stein. That title, Lights Out. Who in the publishers?
And we'll put that in the... We'll certainly make sure that's in the mail to you, Mel.
Yes, do please.
You've been a good friend... And Regnery was certainly very happy when...
What is Regnery, is it? The
when, when you did... When America Alone came out, that was a terrific show to do.
Well, sir, I thank you, and Ezra, I thank you both for joining us. It's been an absolute delight. And we'll say goodnight with that, and goodnight to our listeners. Thanks for some very fine contributions by phone and by email. And we'll be back again on Monday as we talk about with Bart Ehrman about his new book titled... I forget what it is, but it's a study of Jesus and how we misunderstand Jesus. Coming up on Monday. Until then, thanks to all for listening and a most cordial good night.